Hi everybody, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to the latest episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My guest this time is the Australian sailor Paul Larson. Now, it was back in 2012 that Paul piloted the revolutionary Vestas Sail Rocket 2 to a new outright world record speed of 65.54 knots to become the fastest man on water. That record still stands, and in our interview, Paul mulls over the idea of dusting off Sail Rocket 2, perhaps to try and defend his record against two new projects, one French and one Swiss. Both are aimed at reaching 80 knots. We also find out how Paul very first became interested in sailing as a youngster back in Australia, and we step our way along his timeline since then to tick off the multitude of projects he's been involved in along the way. It's another long interview, so let's get straight into it. Paul Larson, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I should say welcome back, because we have done this before, whether it was on this podcast or on a previous version, but it was 2013 and we sat in the ferry terminal in San Francisco while the 34th America's Cup was going on. Is that right? Must have been. And we talked about all sorts of things, about Sail Rocket, about breaking records, about ace, what were they then? ACs. 1972s, and how baffled by those we were, and we talked also about cavitating foils, and that seems to be still a something that's still relevant today. But it's been a long time. But what have you been up to since we last spoke? Lots of things, or have you been hibernating?
Lots of things, I suppose. We keep our fingers in mini pies in sailing, and I suppose once the project of Sail Rocket was over, that then enabled me to go and play on all these things that you'd pushed aside, focusing on your own project. And that went everything from C-class catamarans, which we did the last big event of that, which was right when the all the wing sails and everything was taking off. In fact, I think we sat out the end of that San Francisco one. We were down in Falmouth doing the last little America's Cup down there, right when, and we were watching the finals in between races of that AC34. So, and onto some, you know, some of the big boats, like I say the gunboat style boats, but actually, you know, those big cruiser racing catamarans, lots of mod sailing, Paradox, lots of trimaran action, A-class foiling, dabbling with all that stuff, and of course developing our own concepts through to the Sail Rocket 3 models. So by spending a lot of time offshore and playing with weird and wacky boats, it all feeds back into your own pool of thought for moving forward with sailing with your own design. So yeah, it's been good, it's been busy, diverse.
When you Google Paul Larson sailing, it comes up with Paul Larson is an Australian sailor. I've always thought that's a little bit kind of not the right description. I see you much more as an adventurer and a bit of a boffin, but how would you describe yourself if you could write your own description?
I do often find myself out sitting huddled in some bilge somewhere, thumping along at crazy speeds offshore, and wonder how the hell I got there and why I seem so comfortable out there. I was attracted by certain aspects of sailing, not so much by the Volvo or Sydney Hobart America's Cup sort of scene. I love the innovation of sailing. And that aspect has always drawn me to it, what's possible. I love that in all sports, whether it be aviation or motorsports or anything. I like seeing how people come up with solutions for problems. I guess the interface of sailing has always just absolutely fascinated me. I always say to people, it's a problem that nature never solved. Everything either lives in the air or underwater and touches on that interface. And yet we as humans go out there and build these sailing boats that are expected to live on it, and it's just absolutely intriguing. And although I like going fast on it, that's just one That's just one stream of fascination. Slow boats, boats that carry weight, all aspects of that interface. I just constantly find fascinating. And if one day I get tired of the high performance stuff, I don't think I'll ever dip out of sailing. I think there'll always be a boat or in the shed, or you'll always dabble with it and go and find another little corner you find intriguing. So it is more adventurous, I guess, from a design development way.
So you're UK based and you have been for quite a while. I think we're speaking to you today down in Weymouth, but you're Australian by birth. When did the sailing bug bite you? Can you remember your earliest sailing moment?
Yeah, absolutely. It was. I can almost remember it down to the smell and the sound of the bugs in the air, and it was a summer day in those dams in rural Victoria, and. Dad was building a house, and we used to just live in those dams, and you know, the visibility was about that far, but you'd wear a face mask and stare at a rock underwater, and you know, like, and just swim and run and jump on boards. And this is, we're talking a glorified duck pond here, and one day Dad just brought up a piece of wood and with a margarine lid and put it on it and let it go, and a gust of wind just took it and it sailed, and it was, and you know, you just saw that. And you just started playing with that and changing things around, and very quickly, because it was so basic, you learned how to balance it to make it sail in a direction. You know, what happens if you put the sail there, the keel there, the this, that, sharper, longer, wider. And that just, you know, as kids, as soon as, you know, there wasn't ice on these things, you were in the water and playing around with these. And because you were already building model aeroplanes and you understood the balance of what it took to make these things work, you sort of applied that to this little boat. And looking back at it, I'm amazed how intricate those models got, with absolutely no learning or, you know, nothing else to reference, just using balance to get them going. So that fascination on what makes them work and what is possible, with no one telling me how to do it or showing me what the limit is or it must look like this, that was a big thing. Equally, not long after Australia 2 and that whole wave of sailing, you know, euphoria washed over the country, and to be at that young age, that had an impression of where this might go or what's possible. And once again, we, you know, for the Australians to be seen as the cheeky upstarts with this radical design, that all fed in very well to create this momentum that was just, you know, definitely imprinting.
What was your first actual sailing experience, though, away from designing these little models? When did you set foot in a boat and find out what it's like to sail a boat?
It took a while, and considering what we did recently on the mods with the Fastnet and Channel Record, it was a pretty similar experience in the sense that I remember it being bloody cold, and it was up on Lake Eildon, and we were going up there with friends, and they had a couple of boats and they brought them out, and they were two scow moths, and we took them down and rigged them up, and I remember jumping on there, it was a cold day, and just huddled as Dad sort of with his limited skills at that stage, you know, ducked this around the tree stumps out there in the water, and I just lay on the deck huddled, freezing cold. So that was the first sail, but the first real sailing was on a Hobie, when he came home with a Hobie 14, and we took that up to these lakes, and, you know, the big old Mae West life jackets, and we took that out and sailed that around, and that bright yellow boat with the colourful sail and the trampoline was just... You know, that was just the ultimate toy, and it was fast, and it was fun, and it was just you're the fastest thing out there. Yeah, it was the perfect catalyst. 25080. I remember all the numbers of those boats.
Well, that's always a good sign when you remember the sail numbers from your first boats. I can do the same as well, to be honest with you. But draw the line for me. What you haven't mentioned is sailing clubs and yacht clubs and racing. Was there a path through all of that for you, or were you kind of independent of that?
It came later. And when it when it did, I remember going down to the ocean and sailing out there, and we went out with Dad, both of us on this Hobie 14 to race, and we didn't know where the boys were, upwind, downwind, start lines. It's like we went over to that group of boats, and they all scattered and disappeared all over the place. And by the time we went out to that boy, they were all going that way, and it was, it was pretty overwhelming. But we quickly, Dad quickly worked out that the quickest way to sail was with me off the boat, so I was on the shore. And the Hobie scene was very vibrant there in the 80s. And I guess it came to the stage. Dad bought a 16, but I was coming at exactly the right weight to crew on a Hobie 16, and there were some very talented sailors there. And one of the first one to pick me up and take me for a ride fast around a course and put me out on trapeze was Paul Pascoe, and in Port Phillip Bay. And I still remember we did two laps of the Carrum course and flying around, and Paul was just fantastic as a helmsman, and made me feel like I knew what I was doing. And that was it. I just wanted to go faster and race and win. And I quickly hooked up with some pretty quick guys, and they really knocked me into shape and showed me everything I needed to know about racing, and gave me the hunger to sort of win, be successful at it. And that was a whole different path of sailing, you know. So you went from this radical thing into this one design class. But even then, the skippers were pretty innovative in the way they sailed them and approached them. And that sort of, I guess, polished the racing side of me a bit. And that certainly stuck with me as well. So I was very lucky to come into contact with those mentors.
Yeah, I'm kind of picturing you in this role, and I'm wondering when the technical side of sailing and performance sailing came in, because you're racing one design, these guys are teaching you the technique and the skills and all of that. How long was it before you started to kind of in your own mind start to explore what you could do with boats to make them go faster?
You know, I suppose like a lot of people at that age, when I got into it, I was obsessed with it. I'd hitchhike with a plastic garbage bin with all my sailing kit in it, like long distances, just to have a chance at going sailing. And down in it, once again, so with that Australia 2 culture that was still hanging in the air, these clubs that you're racing at, there was the Little America's Cup boats. I saw those things go past. And I always had this boat spotter mentality of the numbers. I knew everyone in every class. You used to get these Victorian Yachting Council books that said who was the champions, who, what the yardsticks were of this boat and that boat. So I was always fascinated in all the different boats and knew everyone everywhere on what they were up to. I was doing I wanted to be an engineer. I always thought I was going to be a pilot. That's the way I thought I was going to go. And so I got in. I was into hang gliding and motorbikes, and I wasn't bad with my hands at fixing and repairing stuff. But always had this secondary fascination with aeroplanes. So to see something like Yellow Pages and those guys out there on the same race course in the 80s, that was your first glimpse at they were really high performance boats. The other ones you had were skiffs, and the sort of skiff power and efficiency is completely different than, you know, C-class power and efficiency. And once you've seen one of those things go past, it was, especially back in the context of those times, you knew you'd seen a spaceship, and it was that really stuck with me. And I guess all my models back home on the dams, all of a sudden you weren't putting, none of them had soft sails. And they now had the wings on your model aeroplanes were snapped off and they were put on, and you had slotted flaps and all these sorts of things based on that. So, you know, everything I saw down on Port Phillip Bay ended up, you know, being modelled in my dam. So I always had a fascination with models and stuff. But when you're building, before I sort of really worked out what made boats work, every solution you were coming up with, and you know, you tried so many iterations of what makes a boat work, what makes it stable, and it was and you learned things without ever being shown. This is before canting keels, but you worked out you could cant your keel in one direction. And because I didn't have remote control units, I could only send them on one course across the dam. There was no thought of having to tack anything and bring it back. So this kind of lends itself nicely to the 500-meter record later on. You know, you only got to go in one direction. You just got to – always what I needed to see was stability and a certain sense of gust response across this pond. So that was always burning in the back of me. That was my little thing that was always going, how fast can they go? What can it do? What happens if you take away all that other stuff and just focus on that? So there is a direct lineage between the two. Very fortunate, like I said, to get into racing and stuff, because that sets you up nicely to insert you into what everyone else is doing in sailing. That's the thing that gets you on other people's boats to you know, go to clubs and to get chances to sail offshore and steer and start and do all the other things. So but always in the back of my mind was what makes this little boat go from A to B as quick as possible. So when I saw where is it? Hang on, excuse me. It's just right here. Never far away. So when I came up with when I staggered across that book, working up in the Whitsunday Islands in North Queensland, that was the book that showed this way of making a boat work that I'd never nutted out in my own little dam. And it was such a simple book. I mean, it's written in, you know, big basic pictures and, you know, large print, and it just spelled out this thing that was just, I hadn't seen it anywhere else, and it was sort of so simple and obvious. I just couldn't work out why no one had done it. And there came a stage in my life when I realised that, you know, you were the person that don't wait for them to do it, or why don't they do it, that you are them and they, and that's your turn to dig deeper and find out what is the weakness of this that stopped it from working. And you realise it's just a matter of putting the right people and team together and following the numbers through until their ultimate conclusion. And that was pretty much the Sail Rocket story.
So just for the listeners at home, just read out the title of that book, because it's a big, like you say, a big friendly-looking book, quite technical.
The 40-knot Sailboat by Bernard Smith. And, it's 1963. And, you know, this is one of the books where the spine was sitting on someone's library in a yacht chandlery, and they said, oh, but take any one of my books. And there was old, you know, sail trimming books by North Sails and all these legends. And I just saw that title standing out, and I kind of looked at it bemused, and I thought, huh, I wonder what they thought a 40-knot sailboat would look like in 63, and started flicking through it. And it's such a random, casual, freaky little encounter in such an unimportant job in a unimportant place, and this little clue to your whole life is just sitting there waiting for you to pick it up and open it. And I love that. I love how things roll that way.
Yeah, that, I mean, that really is incredible, because I was going to ask the question, where did this dream of you know, setting these records come from? And there it is, a book on a bookshelf that you might have walked past and not even noticed another day.
It was something that you read, and it stuck with you because you'd spent so many years in this pond trying to solve this weights and levers and stability problem. And then at this stage, you'd sailed on all these racing catamarans, you know, small dinghies and stuff. And that just stayed there. But then, you know, the connection that then enabled me to take that forward, getting from reading that book in what felt like a job that was going nowhere to coming to England and being down at Goss Challenges there and having the opportunity to take it forward. So, you know, they say luck is when, you know, preparation meets opportunity, and that's where one of the little, you know, that little book prepared me for when Malcolm Barnsley crossed my path that you were sitting there and you go, I've read that, I know exactly what I'm looking at there, and you're the guy, and it's, you say it's fate. I don't know, maybe you just, it's just one in a million thing, but I was ready and I saw it and I recognized in him as being the perfect partner to help us take it forward. But it makes you nervous when you think of the fragility of these paths that you've taken that lead to, I guess that record on the wall behind me. On the other hand, you sit there and go, well, I suppose there's millions of opportunities that didn't open up, and that's the one that led to me living the life I've led. So, yeah.
So tell us that story of the move from Australia. What was the job? And tell us about the interaction with Goss Challenges.
I never really saw sailing as a career in Australia. It sort of wasn't, but I left my hometown and moved up the coast looking for what I say is my tribe of people who had similar passions and interests. And I found that up in North Queensland, where all the, you know, the Jurassic Park of old maxi yachts, where all go out on charter and everything up there. And I got a fantastic job with a fantastic group of people at Sunsail on Hamilton Island. And one day Commodore Explorer came and tied up over at the Club Med base over at Lindeman Island there as Bruno came to Australia drumming up interest for the race. And I had a Hobie 16. The Hobie World Championships were going to be in Airlie Beach later that year. This is in 98. And everyone was talking about this catamaran. So I grabbed one of the Sunsail boats and went round to Lindeman Island and just remember approaching the headland, and you could see this wing mast sticking up first with this single spreader, just like a big Hobie 18 or Nacra, and coming around that point and seeing that boat, and it was just, I don't think any vehicle has had that impression on me before, just like, it's a spaceship. That is just wow. Look at what do they do on that thing? How fast does that go? You know, it's and yeah, because back then it was pretty hard to get any information on. You know, there'd be one poster on a mate's wall of an Orma trimaran. You know, they were just flying the main hulls. It was the Primagaz bank pop sort of era, and so that was all wonderful and new. But so far away, and to see one of those boats right there and be able to go up and sail around it and just look at it. And I just kept going back and kept sailing around it and around it. And I was lucky enough to come into contact on Hamilton Island with the guy who's looking after it, and just couldn't do enough to get on that boat. So that was with Skip Novak when he came, and four of us sailed that to Japan. And that was my first time out of sight of land, first time across the equator. That night to be put on the helm, that first night to be put on the helm of that boat, and said, you know, keep it below 19 knots, you know, like, and it was this that boat steered beautifully, as did all the Oliair boats. That they were beautiful to helm. And you sat there and go, God, this is responsive, and if I foot off a little bit, the numbers just fly up, and it just felt like it was bounding over the water, and it was a beautiful experience. So we did that, took Cam Lewis's spot for the trip across to from Yokohama to San Francisco, because he was back getting his Team Adventure project together, and it was just such an amazing opportunity. I was just high on life, traveling oceans on these boats with these amazing people, with this history, and realizing that there are people in Europe were actually doing this, and hearing from Bruno firsthand about the race, realizing that, there weren't many of these boats on the water. I think PlayStation was just launched. Steve Fossett was literally flying over us at the time we were going across the Pacific, doing his ballooning record, and on the wall up there is the newspaper from the San Francisco Chronicle that's got us going under the bridge and Steve crashing in the ocean. So it was right. It was all just, you were in the thick of it, you know, and so I got back to the Whitsundays and just. But my mind was like, this is I've just seen something else, and all of a sudden this goldfish bowl has just expanded. There's a whole world out there, and no money or time, but Skip sent me an invitation to his wedding in Italy out of courtesy, not expecting me to turn up, and you know, another one of life's little clues, and I just sort of got no money. How am I going to get to Europe? And a friend just looked at it and said, what are you going to do? And I thought, I don't know. I just got to be there, and just sold everything and sold my hobby and left my combi van in the car park and went to Europe. And that just started a roller coaster. And I see people come over, all young guys now, trying to make a break and try to get into things. And the ones that you see that are really hungry and got the skills and the right attitude, you just look at them and think, just keep going. You'll be right. But, you know, you do have something. Every team needs someone young and keen who doesn't care and doesn't complain, just sleeps on the couch and works. And most people, when they've been in the industry for longer, are actually quite keen because they've been there at some stage to give that person a break. And those first few years were just an amazing roller coaster. I mean, the first 2 years were just insane. You're just from boat to boat to project. I'm amazed at the time span. Like every spare day, if you had a day off, you'd be on a jet, you'd be down in Totnes, and you hadn't been to England because I came over to France, and just to go down there to see Pete Goss's boat. And, you know, at that stage, it was glorified cardboard cutouts down the side of the shed and a couple of molds. But you were there and sending contacts and then back wherever you needed to be. My whole thing was take your bag and go there and be knocking on the door. You didn't sort of send emails and stuff so much back then. And, found my way, worked my way onto Pete's boat. Never thought an Aussie guy would get on that boat. When we first heard about that, it was in a Yachting World thing saying Pete Goss interviewing for crew. And it was just after I got back from Explorer and, which wasn't paid, they just gave you airfares. And I got back to Hamilton Island and people said, why don't you apply for it? And it's like, no, it's, you know, it's the other side of the world. It'll be very British. And, so when I got that email from him that said you're on the crew, but I look back, it feels like it was years. It was months. This all happened in months. Bang, 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 bang. And it was just it was amazing. And it got challenges. You know, I always thought that boat was going to be hard work because it was of the technical challenge they were taking on. It wasn't my first choice. I'd sailed on Explorer. I knew Bruno and the Olier Cats, and I thought that would be the I knew they'd be fast boats. But when I once again by chance met Pete Goss and Andy Hindley and got on with them very well and went over and was given the opportunity, that the boat was fascinating. And you know, I wouldn't have swapped that experience on that boat for anything, without a doubt, even going on the winning boat. And even the way it ended up with losing the boat and ending up on Tony's Legato and stuff, even that was an incredible life experience that tested me to the absolute limit on a number of fronts.
I was just going to say that boat, as I remember, before we move on too far, was a... You said it was kind of technologically advanced. It was wave-piercing bows, I seem to remember, was the kind of big thing about that boat. I mean, was it just a step too far? Was it too advanced for the construction abilities at that time?
No, look, I don't think it was. I think the timeline pressure it was put under, and you've got to remember that Pete got it. His plan was to build it early and to put miles under it well before the race. We were going to do a Jules Verne attempt. We were going to do all these things on it. So he was giving himself work up time. That was always the plan. But, you know, there was problems with the way it was designed and the structure that weren't problems with the technology at all. I mean, of course you can build bows like that can go through waves. All the trimarans are doing it, you know, and leaning on it. The rigs were really good. There was so much of that boat that was good and well engineered, and it was let down by the structures. That's a story that unless you really went through it almost with a judicial procedure to really dig it out, you don't want to until you know hear all aspects of exactly what went down on that, it's really hard to point the finger. But it was, at the end of the day, it was basically engineering, that not putting enough composites into that. Now, how that scenario came about would be the interesting aspect of it. But, you know, it could be resolved by just basically building the structure stronger. It wasn't a fundamental flaw in the concept. So it was really sad that we lost the boat, but that was because if it had came back and it had been resolved, it might have gone again. I think it had already began to spiral away from its original design concept. It had started to get heavy, and when you start to have freestanding, cantilevered rigs and hulls that rely on the boat getting into its mode on one hull, and it gets heavy and the riding moment goes up, then everything starts to get compromised. But it was still an amazing, big, fast, you know, moldy hull that could have done some fun stuff. It wouldn't have been as fast as the Club Med boats, but it certainly could have done enough amazing stuff and been inspiring enough to lead to a second iteration. And many of the aspects on that boat, the concepts you now see, I mean, just watching the new Bank Pop get launched, and, you know, we've certainly seen it in a lot of the AC boats, that the focus on aero and simplicity and cleanliness and stuff, it was a core part of that boat's concept. But, yeah, sad loss.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you're looking at my notes for this call, because just before we joined each other on the call, I was looking at the launch video from the Bank Populaire's new Ultim, and it reminded me of the Phillips boat that we're talking about. It these very narrow bows, very fine. Mm. It's the same color, and it's, you know, how many years different are we right now? I mean, lots of differences as well, I'm sure, in the construction technique, and things have moved on. But it's interesting, I think, to draw a line between these high performance offshore boats and just look at some of these themes, isn't it?
I often think about it, and I'm fascinated at the steps where so often we're held back by our own psychology in actually designing. The technology and the ideas are already there, but it's our own way of interpreting it that is actually holding us back. So, and you're amazed that 10 years later, you look at the design evolution and go, why couldn't we just have jumped that last 10 years in that one step? The answers are kind of obvious. How come it's taken us so long to refine the aero on the platforms when it's, you know, we sit there and we streamline our spreaders up there, and yet we sit down on the deck just below the wing and we stand up with our flappy clothes and you know, coach roofs and all this other junk and spend a fortune up there with all that sort of stuff. And we think the aerodynamics of the boat stops there. It's just, and you look at aeroplanes and you think, we're talking back in the 20s they worked this stuff out. And now you see, you know, Sotobo, and even with Bank Pop, with how far the engine is forward and all these things, that, you know, starting to move this weight forward and centralize it and get the whole boat so it's becoming like this flying platform. You know, I'm pretty sure within the next few years the whole platform of the boat is going to be a lot more aircraft like. And that was the big jump for us between Sail Rocket 1 over there to Sail Rocket 2 was, and you know, this is what this guy wrote about again, that he said, you know, we have to think of it like we're not water people reaching up, we're air people reaching down and touching the water. And it's, you know, he calls it the aero hydrofoil. Introducing the aero hydrofoil is the first line on the boat. And we're going that way in everything we do. And Sail Rocket 2 was definitely, it was more of an aircraft than a boat. So, and that's why the whole thing was cocked into the wind, the aerodynamics. One of the design parameters was it had to be aerodynamically stable. If you threw that out of an aeroplane, it would have to come down in a, you know, might be wobbly, but it would come down in that manner. The theory being, if that foil loses grip of the water, this thing's going to take off, because that foil was holding us down. It wasn't lifting us up like a normal hydrofoil. The wing was doing all the lifting. And if that foil failed or hit anything or ripped off, we saw what the first boat did, but this one had to come and land. And once you got that aerodynamic stability, the boat was just all the fear and the drama of Sail Rocket One just disappeared, and you knew you're in a beautiful, stable craft. And I think, you know, in other designs, we're definitely heading that way. And it'll be obvious. Just sit there and go, how come it took us that long to realize it's a aircraft and not so much a boat?
I want to talk to you about that Sail Rocket project. It's the stuff of legends now. The record still stands. What I was particularly impressed with you with that whole project was how you communicated about that, because it was kind of almost before the days of such advanced social media. But you were doing these really nice videos that were you talking to the camera, explaining what had happened in the last day or two, I mean, from the beach in Namibia. And it just gave people a real sense of being part of it. You didn't have to do that, but it was something you chose to do. What was your thinking there?
I always like to share the journey. I think I learned quite quickly that just open, absolute honesty was the best way to deal with the shortcomings and the failings. It's very easy for people to be critical of those ideas and the radical boats and to pick it out. And so if you showed them exactly what happened and if it was you that made the mistake, you showed that, then quite often people would come on board because, you know, you'd engage with them and not try and feed them crap and tell them it's something it's not. So it was an easy way for me to deal with it. And quite often with some of the stuff I wrote, I'd still be in a dry suit at the end of it, just sitting down and doing I'd almost be writing it out as I'm thinking what just happened out there. And I liked it it was just so fascinating, all those boats and projects, and it still does to this day. I still sit on these boats and think, I wish I could bring people along and show them this real experience. And I always found it disappointing to hear an F1 driver or a pilot when someone would go, what was it like out there? And they go, oh, you know, the tires were off about, you know, at stage two and I couldn't do this. And you're sitting there going, but what's it like? You know, what's it really like? What's it feel like? And so I guess I'm probably in the back of my mind, I'm trying to tell the story to a young, inexperienced, you know, version of myself and put them in the position. And I think it's also a reflection of how fascinating and into it I am. And you just want to share it. You think, God, isn't everyone into this? If I was watching this, what would I want to know about this project? And instead of sitting there feeling unsatisfied when I watch someone else's stuff, you want to sit there and share the emotion and the details and take them there. So it was very rewarding, and I think people generally responded very well to it. And so you kept on doing it, and I still like to do that to this day. It's tell people, like the other day when we're out in the fastnet and stuff, you know, you don't hide the fact that it was cold as hell and uncomfortable, and we're a bit dusty, and you know, I threw up four times. I mean, that's what it was like still at this stage of the game. And I think when you're open and honest about that, most people sit there and go, God, yeah, I thought that's exactly what I'd be doing. Or that, you know, that's what I'd be worried about if I went out on that thing. And it's, and you know, that still happens even to this day at this level. So, yeah, just be open and honest about it. And I think you'll
see. Open and honest is always good. I want to come on to the Mod 70 stuff in a second, but let me ask you a question. The story you've painted for us today from the kid with his really basic model boats that he's creating out of pieces of wood and margarine lids to breaking the speed record. Has anybody ever approached you for the film rights to this?
No, it's in my mind. I mean, straight afterwards, like, you could have written a this and this happened and sort of done it in a sequential way. In a way, in my own mind, I was still very much in the bubble of the boat which I suppose is one aspect of the story. But now that a few years has passed and you look back at it and understand, you can look back at that bubble and understand it for what it was and what you were doing and what was really driving you, that's part of probably the biggest story, the more interesting story. When people go, why do you do it or what does it mean? What you think it's about back then and what you think it was about now has probably changed somewhat. You do put it in perspective. One of the, you know, fascinating or bits that fascinates me about the whole story is that Eric Beale came over here for one of the speed weeks, and Eric Beale was the first guy over 40 knots on a windsurfer. I think he started the whole trench thing down in St. Marie. And we were talking almost on a subjective, you know, philosophical aspect about speed sailing. And I guess thinking out loud, it was like, do you want to see how fast you can go, or do you want to be the fastest? And they're two very different things. Because why, when we just... in 8 days, we turned Sail Rocket 2 from a 51-knot boat or 50-knot average boat up to a 65-knot average boat in just a few outings. All this, what we did was just start to tap into its performance. The boat was structured to go much faster, and yet once we got that record and smashed out the ballpark, you walked away from it. So if you wanted to see how fast you could go, then I'd still be out there in Namibia, you know, going up somewhere, you know, God knows where now. But you walk away at 65 knots and go, I've done it. So that tells me a lot about myself, and I hadn't really thought about it that way. And that's what I say about the psychology of this sport actually holding the sport back a lot of the time, because if we all want to know, you know, we hadn't hit any limits there. We just opened up a whole new set of equations that are now validated to go a lot faster. But I guess for me, that was the bit that was fascinating, and that's what I wanted to do, make that breakthrough. So now as we watch other guys starting to challenge the record come out, and there's two capable teams there. The Swiss ones are looking really good, and I constantly ask myself, am I happy to sit back and watch these guys go, or are you going to, you know, dust the boat off and push it to its limits again? I don't know, but there's a part of me that is almost happy to see someone come along, because it's basically Sail Rocket with a kite, which is basically a continuation of Bernard Smith's book beside me there, of aligning these forces and getting it all to work. And I sit there and go, yeah, I am kind of happy and almost glad to see them come out and finally have a go at it. We'll see when they get close at it. We'll see what happens. The boat's still good to go. But no movie, no.
Yeah, you see, once again, you've asked the questions that I was going to ask you. So You say you're asking yourself, you know, am I happy for these guys to have a crack at it? And I suspect they have a crack at it, it's fine. If they break the record, then I think then you have a decision to make. Well, and maybe that's when we're waiting for the movie.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I guess, these bigger questions and thoughts about, you know, what it was all about and what was the forces driving you, I think that would all be something that would add depth to the whole story. And, you know, I wasn't exactly aware of it at the time. So when I sit back and recount some of these stories and this fragile path of adventure that led through to getting on that boat and sitting on that beach down in Namibia, you know, it does have all the elements of a good story. I remember watching The World's Fastest Indian and thinking, damn it, they made the movie, you know. So it's along a similar theme of coming from a little backwater and going out there and taking on speed.
Absolutely. I think it's coming soon. let's move on a little bit. I just want to check in with you on what you did immediately, almost immediately after breaking the speed record, was you went and did something really slow. And I'd forgotten about it until we set this call up. And I was looking, obviously, doing some research on you. And a week ago, my wife and I watched the Shackleton BBC series on Shackleton. It's a fantastic two-part series and we're completely compelling watching. And we were completely taken in by the whole thing, just thought it was fantastic. And you recreated that that famous trip in basically an open boat. I mean, it was decked, but fundamentally an open boat. Why on earth did you do that? Well,
the story's just, it's legendary. You've read the books. It was just, at first I didn't know the guys. There was so much risk involved with it. It wasn't an environment that I was used to. And I dismissed it at first. And some of the guys involved in trying to get a team together to put it together, they stayed on the case and, they figured I'd just be the gung-ho guy who'd say yes to anything. And I'm a little bit more cautious than that. And even in speed sailing, you progressively work these things up. And that was something you just go down there and you were understanding of the pressures that would be on it. You've seen things go wrong in sailing and you know how these things escalate. Fortunately, with knowing people like Skip Novak and Pete Goss, who was doing some polar stuff at that time, you could call these guys up and get their input. So I thought, and I was heavily focused on Sarok. So I put it, the timing wasn't right. It did feel wrong to say no because you felt like there was this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go to this part of the world and have a stab at it. But I threw the hospital pass on that one across to Nick Bubb, which he caught very well. And then I had a friend who was now inside and I could say, what were the guys like? What was the boat like? And so I was calling him up about it. And we were talking about he needs a second person on the boat just to give the sailors enough of a punch in the decision making that they couldn't be overruled and that you'd have a person on watch all the time and all that side of things. And we were talking about various people, and then the timings changed a little bit, and it just coincided with exactly when we would have finished the Sail Rocket 2 project, so all that record period. And so I said that out loud, and he goes, "Well, why don't you come and do it again then?" And so it was just one of those things. I was making up all these. In my mind, I was making up excuses, and then I caught myself making it. I was sitting there going, why are you making excuses? And just said to Nick, let me sleep on it, and I'll call you in the morning. And I thought Nick will be solid on that boat. He'll be good. He can sit there and do all the preparation and be your man on the ground whilst you're doing Sail Rocket, because I didn't even get to see the boat before we arrived down in South, King George Island. That was the first time I saw it. But Nick had seen it and sailed on it and seen the people. And so he said yes, and it was. I'm so glad I did. I mean, it was so surreal. It was crazy. I mean, to go to somewhere like Elephant Island and stand on it and see this place. I mean, and launch from exactly the same place. That famous photo where they're pushing the James Caird off the beach. I mean, you are standing there and then it's showtime because you've only got a weather window to do this, and all of a sudden you've got to go like to costume and get in this old gear and stuff, which, the previous days you've been rubbing, wax and oils into to make it waterproof. And we wanted to be as authentic as possible. We only had one shot at this, and I didn't want people to come back and be as critical as we had been at other people who made their attempts and like did it in full Gore-Tex or this, that, and the other. Because you only need a very small amount of comfort to completely change the whole experience. You just use a head torch. That changes everything with trying to keep matches dry and wax paper instead of plastic and Gore-Tex socks. We ended up with three people, with trench foot, which is exactly the same as what happened with Shackleton, and we didn't try and reenact that. That's what happens when you wear that stuff and stand out there in that climate on those boats, and it's so to push off on that boat and head out there. But equally, I mean, I came home from Namibia and didn't even stay in this house one night and swapped to a backpack, and we went straight up with the Shackleton mob up to Scotland to learn about the mountains and stuff. It was that quick. So there was times I was down there huddled in, you know, under these deer skins down in the you know, the vomitron that was that boat rolling around down there in the Southern Ocean. And you'd sort of, because you spend so much time below decks that you're not really sleeping anymore. It's so uncomfortable. You're just riding it out, and you'd be sitting down there and you'd sort of think about what it is you're doing. But in the back of my mind, I'm still just going 65 and a half knots. Like, you know, that was so fresh in my mind, and that was 11 years of work. And so, like, I joked all the way across South Georgia hiking, every time I'd have a piss, I'd try and write 65 in the snow, you know, like it was just that those two were so close together. And after that, I got back to this very couch. I was sitting here and just came in, you know, woke up in the morning, sat down here and thought, I said to Helena, this feels like the first day off I've had in my life. You don't realize what pressure you put yourself onto, but after doing those two amazing experiences, and especially they were both incredible, but the Sail Rocket one, that body of work, you realize that you'd put yourself under pressure to achieve, to be, not to fail, all these sorts of things, and I'd scratch that itch, and now you'd proven something to yourself, and you could have a day off and relax and not feel like I have to go out and prove something to the world and myself again. But with Shackleton and that, it was such an amazing experience, and it came so quick. I didn't want to just go out and sign up to the next project or go straight out and promise the world what Sail Rocket 3 would deliver. I just felt like, for me not to sit back and absorb what's happened in this last couple of years and just to let them pass and to reflect on them years later, I almost wanted to bathe in them for a little while and just sit there and think about them and enjoy them. And so, you know, with Helena, we jumped on a plane and went across to San Francisco and just became tourists for a bit and didn't put ourselves under any pressure or promises, and waited till the phone stopped ringing and the emails went away and the Sail Rocket story was told enough to sate everyone's appetite, and just let Sail Rocket 3 grow naturally. I wanted to see what would fill that space on its own without any pressure. And I guess that's where ideas grew into drawings, grew into, you know, whittling away on balsa and models, and they became more and more elaborate, and slowly, you know, Sail Rocket 3 concepts came out, because that's naturally what fell into that space. I didn't have to force it. And
tell us about Sail Rocket 3.
Sail Rocket 3 was born. Speed sailing's a fun scientific experiment. I wanted to see, there was one big unknown, is whether we could get above the cavitation limits set by foils, which was the real sound barrier. It's not a number like 50 knots or 52 knots. Like the sound barrier, it changes with altitude and cavitation point changes with different types of foils and other factors. So once we proved that point, the fact is, you know, we don't fly supersonic, we fly subsonic, you know, we don't drive as fast as all these cars can go. We keep thing within safe limits. And I think the same applies with offshore sailing, that the future of sailing isn't flying around at 65 knots. It's probably consistently going at speeds much less than that and doing some useful work, whatever that might be. So, but it does give you the credibility to take on radical ideas and try them and understand the process of taking those radical ideas and following them all the way through. So with Sail Rocket 3, we started off thinking we'll go across, would this concept work offshore? and I was always slightly skeptical of it because I know how harsh it is out there. And one of my favorite sayings in sailing, in probably life in general, is if it can, it will. And you see that out there, you know, if there's a failure mode, offshore sailing will find it and expose it in the worst possible way. And it's I'm forever out there on boats. You know, we lost Team Phillips. I've seen, you know, failures and all these sorts of things. And when things work, and it's usually the tough, reliable, simple boats, well designed, that win at the end of the day. So trying to introduce a radical boat, as much as I know the gold that lies there, I'm also very aware of how it can fail and how unforgiving not only the environment but the public and the sponsors can be when things start to go south. So that all led into this concept of Sailka 3, and it's basically, it was based on an asymmetric style boat, a proas style layout that used the foil to windward concept. But the problem is that if that foil comes out, the boat quickly goes over if you're just relying on that for stability. And it's all right in flat water where it's sketchy enough as it is, but to go out in the open water and have that happen just wasn't possible. So I didn't want to put ourselves under any pressure by being public about it or, you know, promising anything to a sponsor. And it went back to just building scale models and going out there and in the harbour here in Portland, Portland Weymouth, and just letting this thing go and seeing it capsize a million times and break and be, you know, wildly wrong through various iterations, that we gradually narrowed it down to something useful. All the while, it's the same as once again with this, the numbers had to be right. And so with Malcolm and Chris, we discussed the concept first, and they modified the SAR rocket velocity prediction program, and we start putting this new boat in there. And that's just a vital process. Anything we do, we don't go out there with something we think should be right. If the numbers don't stack up, then we've got to find out why, see if we can cheat them, and if we can't, then we're on the wrong path, we're deluded. So with that velocity prediction program, one of the big aspects when you're talking about scaling it up is what's it going to weigh? And that's something where Team Phillips spiraled a little bit. And so with this one, I wanted to see how much the performance would drop off if we went up in weight. And that's where it really opened our eyes. When we first let the first version of the it was a 150-foot boat, but in a proa, that's not a big boat. Like, we build a 150-foot boat, you think there's nowhere for the humans to sit because it's a long, it's like one hull of Spindrift or something, you know, with a leeward hull. It's a tube, but it doesn't have a lot of volume and stuff. So a 150-foot proa had the same amount of building materials and mold surface as an 80-foot trimaran, for example. So you got this long, slender spear of a boat. And when we first let that go, we know the polars for a few of the big boats, what was Group Armour 3 and you know, the mods and the Ollier Cat generation, we know those. You put them into weather routing software and you let them go across the Atlantic. So you can go to New York now, look at the weather, and put those polars in routing software, and you know where it'll go roughly. And they were going across in about 4 days and a handful of hours, all those generations of boats. And when we let our boat go across and set parameters to avoid 30 plus knot winds and 3 meter sea states, and that boat went across in 2 days, 16 hours, and it was completely different. But it was a real eye-opener, because when you look at the path it took, it just really highlighted how in sailing the rich get richer. And we see that round the – you got so many more opportunities if you're fast. And if you're fast in moderate conditions, that enables you to jump across and make corners and get into different scenarios right from the get-go. And it's it gives you more weather windows that you can go in and all these things. So we looked at that and thought, that's incredible. So you think, if you've got that much under your sleeve, then what happens if you make it heavier and make it out of wood or fiberglass or you know, some sort of new wonder eco composite material. And so we started adding weight to it, and then we quickly realized that it virtually lost minimal performance from adding weight, to the point that we could add its own weight on top of it and it would only lose 10% performance. So it's like getting something like Spindrift and plonking Spindrift on top of it and you know, only losing 10%. And that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And once you saw why, that this long, slender hull, if you add weight to it, on a trimaran or a catamaran, if you add weight to it, it doesn't get into its efficient mode. Everything gets loaded up, the beams get loaded up. You then you go down the spiral of, okay, now we need a bigger wing, and that gets heavier. So now we need a bigger wing and bigger beams, and it starts to become this loop where, you know, a mosquito turns into an elephant sort of thing. Whereas with this concept, it just carried weight beautifully. And that led to the change in focus of, like, well, how much weight can you put on it? And what could you do if you had that extra weight in the boat? And that led to using it for payload or auxiliary engines. And now we're in an era of batteries and renewables. The boats you're starting to sail on since Sail Rocket, the boats like Paradox, Nigel Iron's wonderful 63-foot trimaran, you know, they've got hydro generators on the back. And so you're out there not using your engines anymore. You're using solar panels and these hydro generators, and you're chucking in, you know, like these, you've got powered winches all over the boat, and everything's just powered by that little propeller off the back. And in the side, you're designing Sail Rocket 3, and you're thinking, this thing could, if you don't want to go, the boat always wants to go 50 knots, and we're looking at how we slow it down, you know, like if we're going to use subcavitating foils from 18 knots up, this boat's trying to do 60 knots, so, you know, that they won't last. So do you put a smaller wing? What do you do? And so we went down to the path of, like, if this thing was just, if you put a hydro generator, you end up with a propeller, you know, about yay big, charging, you know, 5 tons of batteries and giving you, you know, a 450 mile motoring day the next day, just off sailing speed, you know, off the excess energy of this boat. So this became the complete focus. And just breaking transatlantic records is really just a factor of time and money. If a wealthy guy comes along now and throws the checkbook down, you'll get, you know, a very skilled bunch of designers and fantastic boat builders, and you'll put a bunch of fantastic sailors on it. And if they wait for a weather window, that they'll go and do it. And if he's got the stomach for the development, you know, you'll go and design and develop and go through that process. But the real challenge for sailing, I still believe now, is to make some sailing boats that do some useful work. Go out there and show. It's just staggering that there's so much energy available to you out there and no one's harnessing it and using it, and it's not viable in a modern commercial business to do so. And one of the only persons, people really, who's followed that path and used it where it's better than anything else out there is probably fellow speed sailor Richard Jenkins, when he's done it with the sail drones and stuff. So those boats are going out as the best possible solution for doing what they're doing, which is fascinating to see. But, yeah, so Sail Rocket 3 went down that path, and so the loads got bigger, and the ability to go out and harvest energy consistently became the focus of it. And I still haven't seen any boat that comes close to the capabilities of what we've designed there. That leads to another aspect, and people go, well, how come you haven't done it? And I suppose you make the change from going and building something like a Sail Rocket, where you can feed that baby easily. It lives in a 40-foot container. Helena and I and some friends and that can go to Namibia and hands-on design, build, sail, campaign, live the fantasy so intimately. And yet when these projects grow, you end up sitting in an office staring at a screen managing everyone else's problems. And I've seen that happen all too many times with projects where the dream is to build the wonderful boat and go sail the oceans, and you end up in just this you know, whole having a whole different experience that just sucks the life out of it. So for us to design and build the models of Sail Rocket 3 and follow it all the way through and see the concepts work and everything go, that's the fun and fascinating bit. It's almost like I want to be a pilot, but I can't be bothered taking flying courses. And when you actually go and do the flying course, that's the fun bit. That's where you first learn and get your hands on the controls and do all the stuff. And so for me, going through this design development phase has been fascinating and insightful. And there's been times when we've definitely wheeled it out in front of some people who are very capable of taking it forward. And you know, I would say the two scariest things a sponsor can say is both no and yes in equal measure, because when they say yes, you've got to go forward and deliver this thing. And I'm very aware that it's if you go down this development path with this boat, that it's going to hoover up, you know, a long, long time. And I will end up spending a lot of time sitting in a room swearing at a computer screen. And it's you'd like it to be otherwise. I'm never desperate to get people to fund it. My whole ego itch has been scratched, thankfully, through Sail Rocket and things like that. So unless we could do this with the right people, it's got to be a good experience with people who understand it to make it fun and worth taking on. So I almost try and dissuade people from doing it unless they really know what they're getting into. And it's so that's why it really probably I haven't gone forward with the fever that I went forward with Sail Rocket, where it just had to happen and work at all costs. With this one, I know it works. I know it's right. I know many of those core concepts I'm seeing come out more and more with other teams and the general path we're going down. But if the right people come along, those maths and those numbers and those practical aspects, this boat's just sitting there ready to go. I'd like to think I'll make it out of plywood and make it just my size and make it work and do a good job of it, and so people can see it. Maybe the first time they see it, it'll be ripping across out there, and you'll know it when you see it.
Oh, I'm sure we will. It sounds like a project that's just waiting for proof of concept properly and then a backer.
Yeah,
really,
it needs a backer who wants to go through the development phase. The development phase is the fascinating aspect of it, and the first time you see that man carrying one let loose and you see this creature come alive, the first time we plugged in this model and turned it on, it's basically a way of it's an integration of concepts where basically the boat can sense its environment and has the correct tools to be able to react to it. So it's not a big winch that trips a clutch and blows a flogging sail out. It senses the roll and the pitch and everything, and it's got the controls to intimately react to it. So recently I went sailing on Sam Goodchild's Open 50 and saw the autopilots and the upside-up systems and everything working, and even just sailing, Pip had the latest NKE gear on her boat for the Vendée, and just seeing how those pilots are developing and how good they are, and especially I'd never sailed with an autopilot on a fast multi-hole before. It had always been, you know, keep your hands on the stick and get ready, these things go over. And to see that thing drive and then sit there and try and out steer it by hand and then turn it on again was like I was driving at 90% throttle, and when you put the autopilot on, it just floored it. It was just so we're living in a time now where it's becoming painfully obvious that we can't keep up with the machine. And it's the AC designers have known it. They just want to kick the guys off and let the machine go and do it, you know. And all the time the machine's showing them how fast they can go, and then they get on the simulator and see if they can match it. And also, you know, if there's some things that the machine isn't seeing that they can then integrate into the machine learning. It's that whole process. So we're going to have to make a decision quite soon on is this sport or is it technical development? And if it's technical development in a car or an aeroplane, we know where that's going. There's an industry and there's a case where that can be used commercially. With sailing boats, that doesn't exist at this stage. We're just racing around, you know, on these races using it for frivolous sports. But to see it actually used commercially for something is a huge thing that's missing in sailing. These races, some of them are becoming less relevant. They're, once again, fantastic for a pastime. I love doing them for my own interests and stuff, but the actual real application for them beyond that is the paths we're going down design-wise, I think we're just missing a huge opportunity for making sailing really relevant again. I'd love to see a race that's set up and a prize money across the Atlantic where the boats can start from central London and no fossil fuels or anything like that are used, and they have to finish with more fuel at the end than they started with. So whether that be battery or hydrogen or whatever you want to use, but when they go out there and set them a course that isn't just trade winds, they got to stop at the Azores and, you know, like do whatever, and just see what people come up with, because there's all these amazing emerging technologies and industries that would love to get involved with sailing, but they don't want to just, you know, give a battery pack to so they can run a, you know, satcoms or something like that. Show us what you've got with hydrogen and battery and renewables and energy recovering systems so these boats can go out there and do these amazing things. This boat I'm talking about that can sail across the world, in, you know, across the Atlantic in 2.5 days, if you make it a motor sailor, then it can get across a lot of the time in a hell of a lot of weather windows doing, you know, using that technology. It goes straight across that ridge. It goes straight through the Azores High. You know, it just dips into these weather systems like power stations, just to A, cover miles, and B, to recover energy. And to do that efficiently, you want a boat that can carry a little bit of weight. So if you move the focus onto that, A, I think there'd be industries willing to fund it, and B, I think you'd start making sailing boats relevant again, because we know they get around the world quicker than powerboats. We know they can do these insane things, but what we can't make them do is any useful work beyond that, and that's a disconnect.
Not yet, Paul. I think with people like you around, those days are going to be over soon. I think your enthusiasm for it all is infectious. I've always known that. And I also really love, Paul, the way that you're a sponge for ideas. You know, you everything you're involved in, you're looking, how can you apply this to the other project and this project, and what can I learn from this? And it's just so nice, you know, nice to talk to you on that sort of level. I want to ask you about the mod stuff. You've been doing some record setting on board PowerPlay, which is a fairly standard mod 70. I'm not sure if it's a modded mod. Tell us about that a little bit, and let's focus maybe on that Fastnet race record.
The mods, I think, are probably one of the best offshore race boats ever created. I mean, they've broken so many records. They're at a stage now where they're ridiculously affordable for what you get to get a boat that can go out there and do those sort of times that is so reliable. I mean, this is a boat you bring back. It's like that first Hobie 14 we had. You hose it off and you go to the bar. They're tough as nails. And I made, you know, the similarity between those boats and, you know, classic race cars or classic aeroplanes, whether they be, you know, Spitfires or P-51s or you know, Porsche 965s, things that just delivered that always, when they went out, everyone who sailed them or drove them thought of them with fondness. And it's every time I get to drive one of those boats on the limit, which is pretty much all we're doing at the moment, because you're chasing records, so you don't get the nice, fun, gliding, graceful stuff. And everything's you know, balls to the wall in the high apparent wind sailing. They're fully lit every time you grab that tiller. It's you're off, and it just makes me smile to just realize, like if you bought a GT40 or a classic Porsche or something like that, and you went out and just savored this thing, it was just fit for purpose. It's they've got these grooves that they drop into. I don't think there's too many surprises left in a Mod 70 for me. I know exactly what it's going to do. The weather's always, you know, can throw curveballs at you, but the actual boat, you know what it's capable of. So I'm quite comfortable driving it. But just doing that last one we did across to St. Malo, from Alderney down to St. Malo, there was just this tiny groove you could drive in, where once you got it in there, the boat just took over, and you could, it felt so edgy. It's Malcolm described it really well with Sail Rocket, that you're riding a push bike along a very high-sided wall, but there's a little groove in the top of the wall, and you want to get it in that groove. And if you step outside that groove, you know, it's a big crash. But if you design it well, it'll stay in that groove. And that must be what it's like coming into, you know, on a great F1 car or MotoGP bike, when you hear the riders say, that you know they're in tune with their bike or their car, that they can throw it into scenarios on that last lap where they know they're not just trying to hang on to this crash. They know they can try stuff with it. And those mods are like that, where in zones that would normally be, you know, what they call, you know, the death zone of that beam reaching angle, these boats just really look after you. And that's what, you know, I saw with Sam Goodchild and how he's trying to set up his boats for single-handed sailing. The concept of trying to sleep while one of these boats is on the limit, you know, I still struggle to comprehend, but the more time you spend on them, you understand how you know, the French have designed and developed them. So we get this team together, and thankfully, amazingly, Peter Cunningham's taken on, he's going to be 80 this year, and he's taken on a Mod 70, and we came out, and at first we started to have a go at a couple of these records, but I think the Fastnet one really gave him the record bug. And it's a love-hate relationship with them, because there's no comfort on them. I mean, there's no, if the person driving's having a ball, everyone else is just in the boot of a rally car, you know, and it gets tiring, and I swear that team on Power Play and Ned and Martin and all that, every time we go out, I'm sure they're just stripping away a little bit of comfort for me each time, because, you know, it looks like, oh, so there's no pillows on board to this time, is it? Okay, so there's no play. Okay, right, so there's no, you know, it's because there's at this stage of your life, wow, to be literally full wet weather gear in the bilge of a boat that's thumping along at, you know, 35, 40 knots, and it's freezing cold, and your fingers are numb like on the Shackleton thing, and it's you're dragging a mesh sail bag over you for a blanket. You're thinking, I'm too old for this. What, this is adults don't live like this, you know? It's this is crazy. And yet, as horrible as it is, it takes you to that place, and then bang, it's over, and you look back at it, what you've just done, and to cover whatever it was, just under 600 miles in a little over 24 hours, and in that Fastnet one, you look at it and go, that's just an amazing experience. I'm thankful for every day I get to sail on those boats, and every time I know I'm going to go through a love-hate thing. It's probably like long-distance running or anything like that. There is a suffer-fest element of it. But there are times you get up there and you're on the stick, and you just with that little muscle reflex there, that whole boat moves and responds and lights up, and everyone on board it is just down to, you know, that sensory input you're getting. It's it's just a beautiful orchestra, you know.
Tell me something about Peter Cunningham. I'm not familiar with him. Until the Power Play record breaking campaigns, he's a sailor, is he? He's an owner. I know nothing about
very much
it.
So. He's been sailing around. He often recounts stories of, you know, sailing in the Solent way back when he came on board just as a passenger, and, you know, he's telling us stories of sailing a Julian Everett designed boat with a canard front foil, how he was only trusted with raising and lowering the front foil to balance the boat way back
way back when, and he talks about the string of boats he's owned. He's quite actively racing J70s, so he's out there training now on the Solent for racing those. So from that keelboat background, but to make the jump to a mod is a big, bold jump. The thing, I guess, one of the interesting things about sailing is there's becoming an increasing amount of people. From when I started, you know, like I suppose professionally sailing back at the turn of the century, it was more corporate sponsors. Now you're finding there's more people with the sort of income and of the age group where these boats and these things are of interest, and they've got, you know, so many years in their life to go out there and enjoy them. And they don't have to be the first to break the ice. They've seen these boats around. Some of the people they come into contact with have sailed on or raced or been a part of these projects. Multi-hulls are no longer the wild, you know, the far cliffs of Jonathan Livingston Seagull lore. It's, you know, they're quite common. So these guys are now starting to dabble in boats like this, which is, you know, fantastic for us. And that was the case with Peter. I think bang for buck, if you look at the cost of something like a Rambler program compared to buying a mod's just dirt cheap, and yet, you know, it'll smash Rambler all day and night. But to do it at 80, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, that fastnet, that was cold. That was seriously cold, and it crept inside all our bones. And yeah, they're probably almost normal now, my fingertips, but you, hats off to him. And he loves it. And, he, every time we can, we get him on the stick and driving it and stuff. So he's good. It is inspiring. I mean, it's one of the things I love about sailing. It's something you can do like golf for a long, long time to a high level.
Well, my theory on this is that adventurers find adventurers.
Yeah. Well, it is fascinating. You know, you do get the opportunity to come into contact with people you normally wouldn't, and there's always an interesting backstory there. And it's it's fantastic with guys like this and to see how they ended up, how we ended up on the same boat, and you know, in some of the debriefs and stuff, to see some of their business acumen, you know, come to the fore, and how they look at the problem of how we're sailing the boat. And it's very easy to be dismissive, but if you listen to it afterwards, when you look back at the big picture, you think, yeah, no, they're pretty spot on there. So they always have something very valuable to contribute.
Paul, I think having people like Peter around is fantastic, because it gives all of us a chance to follow along vicariously with your adventures on this. I know there are more Mod 70 record attempts in the near future. I think you're actually on standby right now for another one, so we'll keep our eyes peeled in the press to see whether that works out for you. But I'm looking at the clock. It's an hour and 25 minutes we've been talking. It's been fascinating. I knew it was going to be. It's never a dull moment when I spend time with you, Paul. So thank you so much for that.
A pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
And that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My thanks to Paul Larson for spending time with me, and to all of you for subscribing and listening from wherever you are in the world. I'll be back soon with another exclusive member-only episode. Until then, I'll just say bye for now.